Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. I am in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam at the moment. I've just got a few hours before I have to go to the Hard Rock Cafe for my show tonight. I've had an incredible week. Last week, I spent the entire week in Hanoi and did a show up there. I love Hanoi. It's small and cozy, really communist, believe it or not, and very strange. All over the city, they have daily news being announced on loudspeakers in certain neighborhoods. Very Orwellian, very strange, but I absolutely loved Hanoi. I think it's really cozy. Got to ride a motorcycle in the rain and do all kinds of cool stuff. Really enjoying my time in Vietnam here. My father fought in the Vietnam War. And so while I'm here, I've kind of keeping my eye out for anybody that might look half like me. I'm having an incredible week, and I got a lot of amazing emails from people that I want to give some shout-outs to. James in London, number one. Wow. It makes me so happy that I have so many listeners in London, because London has been such an integral key to my career, and all the international travel that I've done basically was because I play in London so often, and I've been received so well there. So, James, thanks for listening. Thanks for your message. Glenn in Northern Ireland. I don't know if you know this or not, Glenn, but my Argentinian mother, her great-grandfather came from Belfast. That's right. I've got a Northern Ireland connection. Not many people know that. Paul in San Francisco. Just great messages from people who love the podcast. But this one's the doozy. And I got to read. This guy sent me a really nice long email, and I just want to read you this one paragraph because it's so beautiful. This is from Matt, and I don't know where he lives. He didn't say, but he has a depressing job in the floor covering industry. Wow, that sounds depressing already. So this is the paragraph I want to read to you. Matt says, I'm doing okay in this prison of a life and watch more comedy and comedians than is reasonable to offset my confusing and lost position in the world. It's like someone who watches too much porn and needs to see more and more degrading forms of it. I need to see funnier and funnier comedians to make me laugh out loud. You are the black tar heroine of comedians, and you help the mundane go away in my life. Holy shit! Wow! The black tar heroine of comedians? I have to say, Matt, that's probably one of the nicest things anyone has ever said to me. Amazing. And that put a big smile on my face while I was walking around in the rain in Hanoi last week. This is, you know, Vietnam's a big part of my family history. And today's episode is a big part of my personal history. Today's guest is Rich Scheidner. And this episode was actually recorded at the Safari Inn in Burbank. And that's a little hotel that I like to stay at, or I did like to stay at, because one of the best scenes from one of my favorite movies, True Romance, was filmed there. So we recorded this conversation there. Ironically, the last time I was in Los Angeles, I didn't stay at the Safari Inn because they were having a True Romance festival. And they had jacked up the price from $100 a night to like $400 a night. And you know what? I love that movie, but not $400 a night worth. Anyway, Rich Scheidner came over. He's a part of my personal history because he started at this club in Washington, D.C. called El Brookman's. And El Brookman's is the place that my father took me to see my uncle perform when I was 12 years old. I've told the story many times. You know, I had a Redskins jacket on, the entrance was by the door, and the comedian on stage pulled me on stage and interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins. That moment changed my life. I saw the people laughing. I knew I never wanted to do anything else in my life other than stand-up comedy. And it turns out Rich Scheidner was there that night, and he remembers details of that evening, and he even knows the comedian that was on stage when it happened, which we talk about in this conversation. But here's the strange thing. I didn't know Rich Scheidner was started at El Brookman's and was there that night. I was there until years after I knew him. Rich Scheidner, he's an acclaimed comedian, well-respected. He's one of the older guys that I looked up to. I mean, this guy did multiple appearances on The Johnny Carson Show, David Letterman, Jay Leno. He had HBO specials. I mean, I remember watching him when I was a kid. And then I even worked with him when I was a young comedian. And, you know, he was an older guy I looked up to and I respected. And I still do. I have an enormous amount of respect for him. And the fact that he was there that night makes me love him even more. I found out, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago that he was at El Brookman. So that just put our friendship on a whole higher, different level. It rocketed us into hyperspace as far as friends go. The man's got so much knowledge, so much wisdom about stand-up comedy, where it was, the you know, stories, development, and he's a wise Zen Buddhist master of the art form of stand-up comedy. It is my absolute pleasure to present to you now the one and only Rich Scheidner. Talking about love, everybody talking about loving. Don't be lame, y'all. Got to do your thing. Talking about love, we got to love it. A little time. Hey, it's Rich Scheidner, ladies and gentlemen. very important, my history. I think a lot of people know the story. My father took me to see my uncle do open mic night comedy in Washington, D.C. at El Brookman's, and you were one of the comedians on that night.
I know. And I remember because there was the story, there was a young kid there, and it was everybody's like, there's a kid there. And everybody goes, fuck him. If he's here, he's going to hear it.
Well, it's funny because, like, when I see a kid in the audience, I always get a little freaked out.
Of course, now you do. Of course, I knew too, but I was 23 years old then. I didn't care.
Right, but
we were just trying to get funny.
A young kid, like under 12, I'll get a little nervous and go, you know, can you tell the parents, you know, maybe they don't want to hear this?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
If it's a 12-year-old, I always say to them, hey, kid, in the middle of my set, I'll say, hey, kid, I want you to know. So is that your father? And a lot of times it would be the father. I'll say, I want you to know, my father took me to see a comedy show when I was 12 years old, and that's the reason I'm a stand-up comedian. So, hey, kid, take a look at your future.
That's good.
This is how it all turns out.
I would go, hey, kid, when I was your age, I said the words I'm saying right now, and my dad hit me in the head.
So, what are your memories of El Brookman? So you started at El
Brookman. Yeah, you know, I was doing stand-up comedy from 77, so I was doing it for a few months, and
77. What were there? Two clubs?
There was nothing. I didn't know there were clubs in New York or LA. I didn't know there were clubs anywhere. I didn't know anybody else was doing it. I mean, I knew guys like Robert Klein and George Carlin because I'd seen them. I'd seen Steve Martin. I knew stars, and I grew up with Comedy Island, so I knew. But I didn't know there was any. There were young people doing it in comedy clubs in New York and LA. That's the only place they were. There were three clubs in New York: Comic Strip, Catch a Rising Star, and the Improvisation in New York. Los Angeles had the Improvisation at Comedy Store. That was it. And they weren't even paying clubs. I just started doing it in coffee houses. And my friends had...
What, so like you'd go on like after a folk singer?
That's exactly right. In fact, my first time, I followed a poet. And I got it on the tape still. And the last line of the poem was, like the mango, we are ripe for the revolution. And then the guy comes, like the guy who's the host was this long hair. And he's like a hippie. These were all hippies like hiding out in a basement waiting for disco to end. You know, they were just... And they were holed up there. And this guy introduced, this is my first intro. He goes, all right, this next guy is going to try something funny. Rich? So we're not sure what he's going to do.
Very informal.
Yeah. We're not sure. He said he wants to be funny. I don't know. Well, whatever, man. And I got shushed by two guys playing chess. There were no place to do it. There was just...
I'm trying to take this guy's work.
Yeah, two guys. That was my first heckle. Two guys were sitting up front, and I'm talking. I had like a little 5 minutes prepared. You know what I mean? I prepared, like, based upon my knowledge of Carlin albums, and I prepared, like, what I thought would be funny. And
so are you, you're from Pennsylvania originally.
New Jersey?
Yeah. What is it? Pennsville?
Yeah, wow.
That's it. That's
wow.
That's why. A little Google search, baby. I'm not a witch. I Googled you. So Pennsville, New Jersey. Yeah. So what, you were going to university in D.C.?
I was going to law school, believe it or not. I was going to law school, I thought that's what I was going to do. And a friend of mine in law school said, "You're funny, man. You got to do comedy. You should do it." And he said, I got this. I found this coffee house, this place where they have talent night. You can go there and just do anything you want to do. You got to do comedy." And that's what I did. And I started doing it all over D.C., but just places like that. We'd go to, like, you know, a talent night at a gay nightclub. I'd go do it. I didn't care. I just did it anywhere. A friend of mine had a band. I'd go there where they were playing in this bar in Georgetown in D.C. They take a band break. I go on stage and try to do comedy. Wherever I could. And then I got my first paying gig. There's a place called the Child Harold in on DuPont Circle in D.C. And they did live music. And a buddy of mine was a bartender. I'd hang out there and drink. And one night the bartender says, "I hear you do comedy. You're doing comedy." I said, yeah. He said, "You want to open up for this band I got coming next week from New York?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I'll give you $50. I was like, $50? I'm going to get paid to do this. Man, I couldn't believe it. I've only been doing it for a couple months. And so the next week I show up. And on the marquee outside it says, "From New York City, the Ramones." I had no idea who to. I didn't know what punk was. I didn't know. It's 77. I didn't know anything. So I walk in a place and it's got that. You know, it's punk. I'd never seen shaved heads with mohawks and safety pins through the cheek and you know, just chains from the nose to the ear and bare chested and people with that energy. Just, arr, arr, and I get back to the bar. And
perfect
the
comedy.
Yeah. The club owner's like, "They're gonna kill you, man." He's laughing. I said, "I'm going on." He said, "You won't make 5 minutes." To me it was like, "Oh, it's like a rodeo event. I'm going to stay on that bull for 8 seconds. I don't care. Till that buzzer sounds, I'm getting that $50. And he says, "I'll tell you what, you won't even make it 5 minutes. I'll double or nothing." I think I was supposed to do 15 minutes. He said, "I'll double or nothing. I'll give you $100 if you make 5 minutes. If you don't make 5 minutes, you get nothing." And they introduced me. I don't remember what they said from an introduction. I know all the audience heard was, "Ladies and gentlemen, not the Ramones." They booed me, man. And it was a little club. It's like 200-300 people packed in. You know, one of those stages 8-inch high in the middle of the room. The tables, the bar, everybody's just right on top of the stage. And there's no room for me to be other than right in front with a mic because there's amps and drum kit, you know. And I'm just up there doing my little act that I had, you know. I couldn't go, like, do any kind of special punk material. I just had, like, you know, "My mom said..." I just go right.
What was your opening line?
I can't even remember. I think I did a commercial. Oh, my opening line was, "Don't you love TV commercials?" Something stupid. I did a commercial. The Armed Forces had just started to advertise at the time. You know, like TV commercials for the Navy. I said the Navy, they always make it sound like it's fun. You know, it's like, you know, "You're just out of high school. You're 18 years old. You're in a nuclear sub. You set the coordinates and you set the missile. It fires. It goes off course and hits Philadelphia. But so what? You had a good time." You know, the Navy, not just a job, an adventure, whatever the tagline was. And stupid little jokes, you know. But they're booing me. They don't hear anything. All they're doing is just a wall of booze. And finally, I don't go off after a minute or so, and one of the guys up front just takes his beer and throws it at me. You know, just hits me with a beer. But I just shake it off like I'm standing in front of a boat and got hit with ocean spray. You know, then my dad said, I just go right back to my act. And then I didn't go off, and so the next guy throws his beer at me, and then people just start throwing beers at me. And every time they throw a beer, the audience would cheer, and every time I'd start talking, they'd boo. So it was just like a cheer and a boo. No time at all the club owner figures out that all this beer being thrown on the stage with all the amps and stuff was not a good idea. He just takes the money. He's like waving the cash in the back. "All right, you win. Come on, come on." And I go back. I swear to God. I go back. I'm soaked head to toe with beer. I walk into the kitchen where the Ramones are standing waiting to go on. And they got their guitars, you know, and they're just standing. I don't know who these guys are. These tall guys with long hair. One of the guys looks at me and goes, "Cool act, man." That's what
cool.
I did.
One of the remotes.
Yeah. Like he goes, "That's really cool, man." Like, you go on stage, they throw beer at you. That's what you do.
Like the beer was part of
that. Yeah. That's what you do. You sell a lot of beer. You know that you the club owners love you.
So for the rest of your career, you got to use the opening line of the intro. He opened up for the Ramones.
I did that for a while. But you know what? Everybody, even from the beginning, you had bullshit. You know, from the beginning, when I got to New York, everybody's intro when they went out to some Jersey gig, whatever. "He works clubs and colleges all over the country."
Right.
That was like the bullshit intro.
Still to this day.
Right. I remember once my first wife, we had gone to Florida. We did the comic strip in Fort Lauderdale. This was 1980. That was like the first paying job, like, you know, second one after Garvin's in D.C. Fort Lauderdale, comic strip. We did that, and she went over to visit her grandmother in a condo in like Miami or something, right? So when she came back, her intro then became, she did a successful tour of Florida. One club. A tour. We were just making up, man.
So I just recently got a Facebook friend request from Paul Brookman. He was the son of the owner of El Brookman's.
That's right. He's the one that started.
He started the comedy in D.C.
Like I said, I was doing it, and a friend of mine in law school came up and said, hey, and she showed me like a Washington Post newspaper classified. She goes, look at this. And it said, anybody who wants to do comedy, come to El Brookman's. And I had the address in Southeast Washington, you know. She goes, you should do this, you know, because people knew I was doing it. So I went down there, and Kevin Rooney, Ron Zimmerman, Paul Brookman was the owner. He was starting it. Louis Black was there.
Kevin Rooney started
Kevin
there.
Rooney and was Louis there. Black. Yeah, Louis Black started. John Heyman. There were just a lot of guys who actually still stayed at T.P. Mulrooney, who went up to Chicago. He's a comedian out there. And it was a country western bar. It had a neon sign outside. El Brookman was the guy's boxing name in the 50s. So it had a neon sign of a boxer. And it was this little white bar in the middle of a black neighborhood. And it was country western band. It had these three-piece country western band there. And, you know, like a comic infestation. We took over, threw the country western band out in a couple of weeks. And you saw it was packed. It was just like a little place that was jammed. It became like a hip thing for people in the hill to come down there and watch comedy. I mean, they would pay these little black kids to watch the Mercedes-Benz, you know. Like, here's $5, watch my car. And all these, all of a sudden it was like Mercedes-Benz and BMWs, which I'd never even seen before, were like packed there.
How prophetic that they had a neon sign of a boxer in front of a place that was having comedy. Because a lot of times comedy feels like boxing, yeah, you know? You're against the ropes, you're in the corner, you're getting pounded.
And whatever it takes to win.
I always, you know, my young mind, I mean, I remember the place being packed, and I was wearing a Washington Redskins jacket, and the stage was by the entrance.
That's right.
The comedian on stage pulls me on stage, and he interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins. In my memory, it was a black comedian that had pulled me on. And I wrote this to Paul Brookman, and he said, no, it was T.P. Mulrooney.
T.P. Mulrooney.
Was the one that pulled you on stage and interviewed you.
That's
so
right.
I guess I should thank T.P. Mulrooney for me being a stand-up comedian. Well, I mean, you know, my father for bringing a child to a bar. what were those days like? There were no rules, right? I mean,
there were no rules. We didn't know what we were doing. We do a show, right? Say there's two shows on Friday. We still were doing two shows on Friday night. At first, they weren't charging anybody. Then they started charging like $2 cover, and the comics would split up that money. But the thing was, you didn't have a lot of material, so you'd do the show. But the same crowd would stay pretty much for the second show. So we'd go out in the park a lot out back, you know, smoke a joint, try to figure out what to say next. You know, try to write something new for the by smoking and just talking to each other. And I'm going to try this, I'm going to do this. And so you're just grasping, and there weren't any. But that one paying job that I got, I started doing opening act work for bands. Like the fact that I even just hung out there and did that Ramones thing. And some other guy, he told a guy from Cellar Door Productions. So I started getting like paying opening act work.
Yeah, well, how long was it before you got good that you could be an opening act?
Well, I was opening act before I was good.
Okay.
If you were willing to walk in front of a rock crowd, like I said,
get beer thrown in.
Yeah, exactly. They had a contractual obligation to provide an opening act. So in no time at all, the Cellar Door said, you know, if they don't specify, they'll provide me for $50-$75 a comic, or Rich Hall, who was also doing it at the time around there, and he was actually pretty good, then rather than pay a local band for $500, $1,000. So, and there was no equipment change, grab the middle mic, you know, to take the middle mic. So I opened up for all sorts of groups, but there was that. We were all just trying to get better. There was no other place. It wasn't like we were trying to find other jobs. Like I once started a comedy night at a pizza joint, you know, just going there. And it was insane because people are coming and eating. You know, it's like it's a mutating, shifting crowd. There's no like an audience and the show starts. People would sit down and eat, and there's a comic going in front of them. They'd leave, and then somebody else would sit down, and we just do comic after comic. We were trying to make some money and get some stage time, that's all.
Who were some of the bands you opened up for?
Oh, my God. I opened up for Rick Danko, opened up for Little Feet, for the Plasmatics, for Jerry Lee Lewis.
Wendy O. Williams George and the Plasmatics?
Exactly.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I didn't care. Chicago, all sorts of bands that were big and small. And,
So at what point did it come where you thought, I need to expand my horizons and get out of D.C.?
I didn't. A friend of mine then said to me, she goes, you know there are comedy clubs in New York City. I said, what? She goes, yeah, they're comedy. And she lived in New York City. So she took me up to New York City, and we went up there, and I was like, we go over to the Improv, couldn't get in. It was a Saturday night. Couldn't get in there. go over to Catch a Rising Star, couldn't get in there, went over to the comic strip, got in, sat down amongst these people. I was like, oh my God. I was sitting there with about 300 people packed on a Saturday night waiting for the show to begin, and then watched one comic after another go on stage. And every comic go on stage, you know, in your like cocky mind, I'm thinking, I'm funnier than this guy. I'm funnier than this guy. Then one guy came on last, and I went, oh, I'm not ready for this guy. And it was Seinfeld. And he had, you know, his, even then, back then, he had tight, well-written material, you know, and I thought, I'm not know if I'm ready for New York yet. And then around that time, Garvin's opened up, the first paying comedy club on the East Coast. It was like, you know, the first paying one on the East Coast. It started paying like $250 or $300 a weekend for comics to come down from New York. So I went over there and started emceeing. I became the house MC at Garvin's. So I met all these comics, Belzer and Say and Overton, and all these guys were coming down to work at Garvin's from New York. And Glenn Hirsch and these guys, and they were like, you got to move to New York, man. So by, you know, August of 79, I moved to New York.
The D.C. audience, I mean, I remember my uncle took me to Garvin's.
Yeah.
Probably when I was like 15, 16.
Right, right.
And I remember that was a pretty hot little
club. Immediately, when they opened that place up, boom, packed.
So that was the first club in D.C. that started bringing the headliners.
Yeah, they started paying. It was in Northwest. Well, you remember it was on Connecticut Avenue in Northwest. It was in a very rich, wealthy area just off of Massachusetts, just off of Embassy Row. You know, it was like a very wealthy area. So it became packed and hot immediately. And it was, and you would, you know, I don't know what the cover charged, $5 or whatever. But yeah, they started bringing in comics from all over, you know, from D.C. I mean, from New York and L.A.
So from there, you moved to New York?
I moved to New York, and I went to New York, yeah. Yeah, and I couldn't make a living at it at first. My last job, I was literally hanging around, not being able to pay the rent, lived down in the village, and my landlord goes, hey, man, you're not doing anything. You want a job cleaning out apartments? And I was like, yeah, thinking, yeah, I can clean out apartments. I can do that, you know, whatever it was, $5 under the table or something, you know. And it was actually cleaning out people who lived in apartments. They were all these, you know, squatters down the village. Village was a lot of buildings with squatters and abandoned buildings, and they were starting to rehab New York. And the mob was buying a lot of buildings. And I was with this little crew of young mob guys that every morning we'd get out and we'd go and we'd throw squatters out of apartments. You know, we'd ask them to leave nicely. If they wouldn't, we'd get in, we'd just throw their stuff out of windows and all. And we were getting hammered in the morning, drinking schnapps and stuff, and going in and rousting people out, clearing out buildings so they could come in and redo the building and rent it out for real rent. And the city was selling these buildings to people cheap. So that was my last straight job.
You must have been, that just must have been so much drugs and alcohol in that period. And
oh, my God.
New York City.
It was... That was a time, and these clubs were all packed, like the Improv and Catch and Comic Strip, they were packed.
It was the hot thing to do.
It was a hot thing to do, and it wasn't, you couldn't go to your local town and see a comedy show. You couldn't be in Massachusetts, I mean, maybe Boston, they had some comedy club, the Ding Ho and all, just started by then. But I'm just saying, you couldn't be in Connecticut and go, I'm going to go to New Haven at the comedy club there. You wanted to see comedy, if you heard about it, you went to New York City. So between the Bridge and Tunnel crowd and tourists, these places were packed all the time. And I saw so many great comics, dude. Good stuff. I mean, I saw, you know, Robin Williams came in at the height of Mork and Mindy, you know, and I was emceeing, and, you know, you see that, you know, you see him like, it's Robin Williams, you know, and the audience just stands up and they're screaming to see him, and it was really weird. I mean, I remember that, I'm just going off on this, he was, everything he did, they laughed at, everything, every move, they screamed at how to, and when he walked off stage, he came in and stood in the back, and I had brought up the next act, you know, I'm standing in the back of him, we're just watching the show, and not to me, not to anybody in particular, he just had this look on his face, he goes, I don't know what's funny anymore. You know, you think like...
Because they're laughing at everything.
They're laughing at everything. So he had no balance anymore. He didn't know... He couldn't judge. You and I think, I'd love to be at the point where they just laugh at everything. They think I'm so funny. Then I go, well, that's really a bit of a curse, too.
Yeah, when you're that famous and they just... I mean, I think that a lot of people are just going to see celebrity now. Right. And like, just, they think they're on TV and I just adore this person from mm-hmm. the moment they come out.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, Robin Williams gets standing ovations when he walks out.
Right. Right, well, then he was the height of Mork. He was just insane, you know. And I was there, you know, I saw some great things, you know. I mean, hung out and watching Rodney working all the time, and, you know.
Rodney was one of my all-time favorites. So did you tell me about Rodney.
Rodney, you know, his club, they didn't hire us young guys because he had, like, David Fry and Jackie Mason. All the guys from his generation worked there on the weekends and all. But he would have these after-hour shows where he'd bring in, like say, proms, like, for all these kids from Long Island. you know, young and drunk, and they charge them a lot of money.
They still do those prom shows,
right? Yeah. And you'd work, you know, you'd do the prom shows after they finish the regular shows at midnight. We'd do prom shows till like 4 a.m. You know, and you get like $75 a show, and it's just gladiator work. You know what I mean? You just sit there with a fork and a net, you know, just stabbing them and rope, you know, just, and it, you know what it is. And so Rodney would sit in the back and laugh, watching. He'd finish his shows. You could hear him laughing. You'd be like bombing. You could hear, you know, right? And I come off the one night, and Rodney comes up and goes, "Hey, kid, you got a lot of guts. You stay up there, you know? You stay up there. I like that. Hey, you want to do some cocaine?" And I'm like, "Cocaine with Rodney." And I was like, "Yeah, I want to do cocaine with Rodney." And so we go downstairs and do cocaine. By the way, it was actually the first time I ever experienced, like, there's a difference between drugs. There's celebrity drugs, and then there's regular street drugs. And I was doing street drugs, like my coke that I was getting, I realized was so cut with baby laxative. You know, you do a line and you take a shit. You know, it's, you know what I mean? It's just, you're more regular than high. But Rodney's, man, one line of Rodney's like, "Whoa, this is that. Oh, that's what cocaine is." I've been snorting white powder, but I have not been doing cocaine for 100 a gram. And so I'm doing it. And so I got Rodney there, and I'm like going, "Hey, you know, I just want to get better, man. How do I get better?" He goes, "Hey, do you tape yourself?" I go, yeah, I tried. I can't stand my voice. I sound like an idiot." "Well, of course you hate yourself. You're a comedian. You got to listen to yourself. You got to tape yourself. It's the only way to get better. Because the audience will tell you what's funny about yourself. They'll tell you. I mean, individually, they may be orangutans, but as a group, they're genius. Listen to what they're laughing at and do more of that." And it was like great advice. And then here's the other thing, though. Rodney, you know, when he got off stage, he had his robe. He put his robe on. And he never wore anything under the robe. And he never bothered to close the robe, you know. So as we're doing coke off this glass table in his office, but every time I bend down to do a line of coke, I can see his balls hanging underneath the table. And that's like, you know, there's no such thing as free cocaine. That was my other lesson that night. But, you know, Rodney was like, he would come in. I'll tell you another story. He would come in and, you know, you're on stage. If you saw Rodney at the light in the improv, the light where they give you was back by the bar, and the audience couldn't see it because it was back the a little bit in the aisle. But if you saw Rodney come under the light, that means get off now and bring him up. You know what I mean? Like, you'd be mid-joke. I would be mid-joke. I'd be so reverential. I'd be like, "So then the..." And I go, "Ladies and gentlemen, we got a special treat." And, of course, they'd go nuts because Rodney was so hot. He was doing Carson every couple of weeks, you know. And he was always great. One night I'm seeing, and Pat Buckles, who was the manager, says, "Hey, Rodney's on the phone. He wants to talk to you." So I get on the phone, you know. And I was not friends with Rodney, but he knew who I was, and I knew. And he said, "Hey, listen, I got this joke, this new joke. This guy sold me a joke. It's a great joke, but he sold me a lot of shit, you know what I mean? And this joke's too good. It doesn't fit with the other ones. I've got a feeling he stole it, you know?" So he tells me the joke is, you know, "Whose joke is this? Is this anybody's joke?" And I said, "Yeah, it's Ronnie Shake's joke." He says, "Oh, I knew it. Give me his number, will you? Give me his number." So I gave him his number, and then Ronnie Shake's came in the next night, and he told me, he said, "Hey, thanks for giving Rodney my number. Here's what happened. Rodney had bought the joke from a guy, right, and had done it on stage once. He's getting ready to do a Tonight Show that week, that Friday night, and he'd done it, and it killed. Of course, he knew it would, but he's suspicious, so he called around. That's how much integrity he had, right? I mean, you know, that's the easiest way for stars to fence jokes, right? Hey, I just bought it, man. I didn't steal it. I just bought it." And he didn't. And then he called Ronnie up. He said, "Listen, I've already done the joke. I normally pay $50 a joke. I'll give you the $50 anyway because I did it. If you don't want to sell it to me, I understand. I'll never do the joke again, but I love the joke and I'd like to put it in my set for this Tonight Show coming up. I'll give you $250. I normally give $50, but I'll give you $250 for this joke." And Ronnie Shake said, "Yeah, I'll sell you a joke. It'll be my honor, but I don't want the $250. Just give me the regular $50. So then he hangs up. Rodney calls him back an hour later and says, "Listen, I got 2 first-class tickets going to L.A. for the Tonight Show. You want to come with me?" He takes Ronnie Shakes out to L.A. when he does the Tonight Show. Not only that, he goes and sees Ronnie Shakes do a set at the Improv, right, the next night. He calls Jim McCauley up to book the Tonight Show while Ronnie Shakes is out in L.A. with Rodney. I know this is Rodney. It's tough to differentiate.
Yeah.
But he calls up Jim McCauley, who booked the Tonight Show, and sets up an audition for Ronnie Shakes at the Improv in L.A. And Ronnie Shakes gets the Tonight Show out of that.
Wow.
That's who Ronnie Shakes was, but that's also who Rodney Dangerfield was. That's how much integrity he had, how much he loved Young Comics, and we all loved him. Everybody loved him. because he was just a wild man. I remember once I was standing down on Times Square, you know, it was after the show, it was like 2 in the morning, I'm just smoking a cigarette, looking at, you know, this is what Times Square was like, heating, you know? This is when it was like hookers and walking around naked.
Peep shows.
Yeah, peep shows and drug addicts. I'm just watching it all. And all of a sudden, I noticed this presence next to me, and I turn, it's Rodney, he goes, hey, kid, it's all happening here, isn't it? Oh, wait a minute, here comes my date. And a hooker walks up, and he walks up and walks off with him. He was a wild man.
That's great. Any other great Rodney stories?
No, no.
So who else?
I could dip into Robert Schimmel. Had like a million of them, but
I love Schimmel.
Schimmel was great.
Oh my God,
he had a million Rodney stories.
Well, and you know what? That was the thing. You wrote the you compiled the book I Killed.
Yeah,
and it was comedians all their best road stories. And you called me about this story that involved me and Schimmel. And David Feldman had told you this story.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was in Atlanta, and I was a really young comedian. I was the opening act, and Schimmel's headlining, and he had been through a lot of stuff. He was taking these pills. I don't know if they were, you know, downers, or I don't know what the hell they were exactly. So we were over at his nice hotel, because me and Feldman were staying in the condo house, and we're drinking this really nice red wine all night. And I wasn't a wine drinker at the time. I'm just enjoying hanging out with Robert Schimmel. I, you know, looked up to him, and I thought he was brilliant. And then he says, you want to do, you know, one of these pills? And I'm like, yeah, whatever my hero says. And Feldman says, don't do it. And I did it, and then I ended up naked and vomiting on the yard, the grass of the Atlanta condo house for like, I don't know, 8 hours. It was a very long, difficult evening for me. And so you asked me about this story, and I wrote it up, and I told you, and it didn't make the book. I was like, I have so many more better stories than that. It was just,
I know.
I wish I'd have given you a better story.
Well, a lot of people said that too. Kevin Rooney said, oh, I should have given you a better story.
You know, and also, I mean, I respect you. You know,
I looked up to you,
and I was like, fuck, I would have loved to have been in Rich's book.
Listen, first of all, we didn't have a choice. Like, Random House decided to pick stories. Like, we fought for some people. Like, you got to put this in, you know. And sometimes we lost. Even comics, you know, who are good name comics, didn't get in because Random House says, nah, it's not a good enough story. Or they didn't like it for whatever reason. But you're right, man. I should have said, give us something else, you know. I mean, but Schimmel, I just sent the stories that he gave us. They're all transcribed, you know, all these stories we got transcribed. I sent them all to his brother, Jeff, because he's doing a documentary. And Schimmel gave us about 20 stories. I mean, he went on and on. About 20 stories. And, you know, some of them were Rodney. And you ever hear a Steve Martin story?
Mm-mm.
Oh, I love this. You know, he's out here. Schimmel was a stereo salesman at first. When he's knocking on and trying to get into comedy, he moved out from Phoenix. And he gets a call. He's working over at Federated in Hollywood. And they go, Steve Martin wants a high-end stereo. You know, I'm doing it. I'm doing that one. So Schimmel runs over there with a big high-end stereo and starts setting up. I can't help myself. I'm doing my act for Steve Martin. He's sitting there watching me set up, and I'm taking my time, and I keep trying my jokes, and one bombs after another bombs, and I'm bombing in front of Steve Martin. I got an audience of one Steve Martin, and I'm bombing. And finally, I can't help myself. I'm blurted out. I'm taking too long, and I know I'm irritating him because I'm taking too long. And I'm doing jokes. And at one point, I just blurted out. I go, hey, you know, Steve, I'm a comedian too. And Steve goes, really? No, you're not. You're a stereo salesman. He goes, yeah, how do you make your living? He goes, stereo salesman, that's what you are. When you're making your living as a stand-up, then you're a stand-up comedian.
Wow.
And Schimmel went, he was absolutely right, man. He said, I was kind of, you know, oh, yeah, you got me. He says, I deserved it because I was so, you know, he couldn't help himself just doing joke after joke after joke.
That's funny because, you know, you just think Schimmel was so, like, dominant. And such
no, but
beast,
he's like, but, and, like, you, like, me, like, everybody
young.
Else, you start
everybody's
off,
young and goofy
yeah,
when they start.
Yeah.
What were some of the other best stories from the book?
Oh, man, there were so many. Well, you know Schimmel's one about coming out here, don't you?
Mm-mm.
Schimmel was in Phoenix working. He's a stereo salesman. Got a family, wife and kid. And he comes to L.A. for an electronic convention. His sister, somebody talks him into going up on an open mic night at the Improv. He does this from UNC, he's prepared. Bud passes him. Passes him. He says, you can come back and work out here. Schimmel thinks, I'm in show business. He goes back to Phoenix, tells his wife, I'm quitting the job here. We're going out to L.A. I'm going to have a career as a stand-up comic now. And he packs up the family, like the Klampus puts him in a U-Haul. They're driving. His wife's complaining the whole time. This is crazy, insane. You're not a stand-up comedian yourself. We just left our home in Phoenix, and we're going. We don't even know where we're going. He says, trust me, I'm in show business. And they're coming in town like early in the morning. He says, I'm going to show you where I'm going to perform. I'll show you where I'm working. The Improvisation is a big comedy club, and that's where I'm working. I'm a comedian there. I'm going to show you. So he drives up. Doesn't know the night before, the Improv had its fire. It's his fire. So he pulls up to show his wife where he's working, and it's smoldering ruins.
I never heard that
yeah,
story.
Yeah, yeah.
Schimmel's one of my all-time favorite comedians.
Oh, he was great.
He was a good man.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
So what are some of the other best stories in, from the book?
From the book or
from,
well,
your career?
I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, we started, you know, there were I got a lot of stories, but there were, you know, when all these clubs started, some of them started and they were professional and well done, and sometimes they just, the clubs were just popping open and they didn't really, you know, they just, okay, we're in this venue now. Like, I remember 1980, they said, somebody said, you're going out to work at Mickey Finn's in Minneapolis, right? They're paying you to come out. A couple $100, airfare, whatever. So, yeah, of course, I'm going to go out there. And I get out there, you know, and the first night you get there, the local scene is there. And at that time, it was Jeff Cesario and Louis Anderson and I think Joel Hodgson and Alex Cole and Wild Bill Barrow, all the local comics there. I know you can see them. You know who they are. You feel like you're the gunslinger in town, right? They're looking at you, goes, let's see who this big New York comedian is. We paid this money to, you know, has he got anything? Is he, you know, you're thinking, I gotta bring it. I gotta bring it first show. I gotta bring it. And I got my Walkman on, my blasting Elvis Costello. I'm getting pumped up, man. And I look at that stage and go, I'm gonna hit that stage, man. I'm gonna run up there like a rock star. I'm gonna jump on that stage and grab that mic and go for it, man. Now, I have not checked out the room at all, not checked out the stage. I went up there and run up on the stage after the intro and jump up on the stage. Well, the stage was just a sheet of plywood sitting on a bunch of milk cartons. So I hit that stage and the whole thing surfs. The whole thing just flies off. And I go flying into the wall, knock over tables, bounce, and hit my shoulder like partially separate, which I found out later. I didn't know the time. I just know my shoulder was killing me. But you know, there's a room full of people. They're all cheering and going, yeah, this is wild opening.
This guy's a wild man.
He's a wild man. Well, you got to back it up now. You got to stand up and do your act. And you can't go, my arm hurts. My arm, anybody can help me, my arm hurts. You just got to do it, right? And then after the show, I'm like, my arm hurts. You know, these guys are like, let's go to the hospital. And the doctor, the x-ray, they go, yeah, you got partially separated. Here's some pills. And Wild Bill Bauer goes, he'll need a lot more than that. They give you like two bottles of painkillers, you know? Yeah, okay, good. But there were like these places that are popping up all over that sometimes they didn't bother with, like, you know, we really need to have the right equipment. I remember one place in Toledo, Ohio, that Rooney and I went to, you know, it was one of these deals where we're in Columbus. They go, you know, clubs are popping up so fast. The guy in Columbus goes, hey, I got a new club in Toledo. Go up there and play this club in Toledo. Well, we drive up. He gives us a car, like a 1976 Pontiac. It's got bad muffler system. I mean, the car is filling up with carbon monoxide. We're driving. It's the middle of winter. We got the windows down, you know, because the exhaust is coming in the car. We're driving to this gig. And we get there, and it's not even in Toledo. It's in this place called Perrysburg, outside of Toledo. It's not even in that town. It's in, like, this big barn disco in the middle of a cornfield, right? And the comedy club is like a little pimple room on the side of this. And not only that, they had a terrible sound system. I mean, I don't know what the thing was, but it would pick up the AM broadcast.
Through the sound system.
So, you know, you'd be talking all of a sudden, it would cut in and goes, all right, the Rockets are bringing the ball up the court, you know, and just cut in. And then sometimes it would short and you'd go to grab the mic and a blue arc would fly off and zap you, you know. And it was all starting, and it wasn't like, oh, we've got the money to, we're doing the proper improv in Toledo or the proper improv anywhere, whatever. They weren't franchises, they were just these guys going, look, I went to New York and I saw them packing those comedy rooms, and I went to Cleveland, guys got the room there. I'm going to open up a room in Cincinnati or whatever, you know. So it was,
so who were like the hottest guys, the, you know,
the guys in the Midwest. There was a show back in the late 70s, you remember, called Make Me Laugh.
Oh yeah.
So those guys
and Wild Bill Bauer was on there with the diaper.
No, that was Bruce Baum.
Okay.
So all those guys in LA at the Comedy Store mostly, the Bruce Baum and Mike Binder and Vic Dunlap, right? All those guys and Kip Adada, they were on Make Me Laugh. They were big stars in the Midwest. They could actually draw. that was a show that was on syndication in the Midwest, like 11 o'clock at night. It was a big hit, that show. So when these guys would open these comedy clubs, they always wanted the LA acts in first, you know, they were big acts. And Then guys like Ollie Joe Prater. You ever hear of him? Remember him?
Oh my God.
Ollie Joe.
What? Nobody likes to party?
That's my, I was there. That's my story.
Then tell the story.
Oh my God.
People who never heard the story.
So I'm in Pittsburgh. And it, and again, these clubs would open up so fast that the Pittsburgh Comedy Club opened like 1980 or whatever. And they were packed and they were getting so much business, you know, immediately going from like 4 shows a week to 8 shows a week to 10 shows a week. They opened up a satellite club out in the suburbs, right? In the suburb of Pittsburgh. Well, I was working a suburb one weekend and Ollie Joe Prater was working downtown. Now, the suburb only had 2 shows on a Saturday night. Ollie Joe had 3. So I was coming in to party with the club owners, you know, so I finished my second show and I'm coming in from Monroeville, whatever the place was, in the downtown Pittsburgh, the party with the guys who go to After Hours Club. So I get there and they're starting a 3rd show. So I'm in the back of the room. I've never seen Ollie Joe Prater. Now, Ollie Joe was like, the blue collar guy. What's his, Larry the Cable Guy before Larry the Cable Guy.
Right.
His real name was
400 pounds or something?
No, he wasn't at the time. He was just a short, he looked like Yosemite Sam. He wore a cowboy hat and boots. And he was a short, stocky guy. He wasn't overweight at this time. This was back in 1980. And he did like a real southern trucker kind of, you know, hey, but his real name was Gilbert Herzog and he was from Michigan.
Wow.
But he, you know, he created this character, this Ollie Joe Prater, this wild country western trucker kind of guy. And he used to steal a lot. You know, the old joke was, I don't know whose joke this was, but somebody said, if Ollie Joe Prater buys you a drink, you know he just stole one of your jokes. If he shares a joint with you, he just did a couple of your jokes. If he gives you a line of cocaine, you just played Cleveland. You know? So he was real liberal about what material he used or who, you know. And so, but I was in the back watching. And Ollie Joe used, when he came in, even this early, he had rules. Like they had to provide him right off the bat with 1/4 ounce of cocaine and a bunch of Quaaludes before the week even started. I mean, he partied, but he was one of those guys who drank on stage all the time. Club owners loved him because the rooms were packed. And who made the difference was the guys who could sell the most alcohol. So him and John Fox, they sold, because they drank on stage the whole time. They sold a lot of booze. And so I'm watching Ollie Jones, like the 3rd show Saturday night, and I see he's rocking a little bit off the bat. And I could see he's staggering a little bit. He's drinking, you know, everybody drink, come on, drink. Hey, hey. And he takes a shot and he drinks. And then he starts bleeding out of his nose. And he doesn't know. He just feels something coming on his lip. And he's wiping it with his sleeve. Now, there's red blood coming on his white sleeve. And he's got a vest and a white shirt. And the audience starts to see it. And they're going, oh. And it's spreading. You know, your audience. And he's losing them. And he looks down. He realizes all the blood. And that's when he says, what, you fuckers don't party? You know? You do coke, your nose bleeds, you know? And then he takes a couple more shots. And he literally passes out. I mean, I see him rocking back. You know, you're rocking. But this time he rocked back. He didn't come forward. He just went back and bam, went down. But he still got the mic and a mic stand. He's still holding it. And he's still talking into the mic. So he's laying down. You just see his boots. And you hear his, I'll tell you this, fucker. And he's like mumbling into the mic. He's out. But he's out and still talking. So Bruno Schreppa, who was the club owner, he grabs me. He goes, we got to get Ollie Joe off. You got to finish the show. That's a packed house. Packed house, and they're just, people are just standing up looking, and he's lost the entire room. I mean, everybody's just looking what's going on. And so, like, a bunch of guys run up on stage, they pick Ollie Joe up, and we literally had to pull the mic out of his cold hands. I mean, you know, it's like a gun, like, you had to pry it. He's like, but he's out. And they carry him off, and I stand up and go, all right, folks, welcome to Pittsburgh. Like, it's like nothing happened. It's like professional wrestling, you know, it's a tag team match. One guy goes down, you bring another comic out, and I finish the show. And Ollie Joe, they had to carry him to the Viking Hotel and, like, literally throw him in a car and throw him in a thing. And that was it.
Appropriately staying at the Viking Hotel.
Viking Hotel.
So who was, like, the wildest comedian back then? I mean, as far as, like, partying and drugs. I mean,
well, Ollie Joe, John Fox. John Fox was legendary. I mean, I said that if you went into town and you played a club after John Fox, all the waitresses would be on detox. I mean, they would be like, you know, they'd be scratching their noses. They'd be looking at you. Are you going to do coke like John? Because he would blow his whole paycheck. I mean, he was one of those guys who did, you know, at the end of the week, you know, back then you could make 6 figures just being a road act without, you know, you'd make 25, 3,000. They just paid guys who could hold the audience for long periods of time. It wasn't like, do 45, don't do any more. We're giving last call at 45. They would be like, can you do 2 hours, 3 hours? Do 3 hours. You want to do 3 hours? Good 3 hours. We're selling drinks till you say you're done. Then we just collect the checks. They didn't care. They didn't care about drunk driving laws. They didn't care about any of this stuff. Just sell as many drinks as you can. So guys like John Fox sold drinks. He was getting early on, you know, back in the early 80s, he was getting $3,000-$4,000 a week. But he was blowing it on coke. I remember one time I was sitting at the Punchline and Ron DiNunzio, you know, remember those guys?
Of course, right? Yeah.
We're sitting up after the show doing our little party, and they get a phone call, and Dave puts it on speakerphone, and it's John Fox. And you could tell he's in a bar. You could hear the background. You hear it back, and John Fox, hey, Dave, it's me, John Fox. He goes, what are you doing, John? He goes, yeah, I'm over here in Mobile, Alabama. He says, can you give me an advance on my next booking? And he goes, John, you were just here. You're not here again for 6 months. What do you mean advance? I need a couple of $100 to get home. And he'd blown all his money in Mobile, you know, and he's one of his deals at the end of the week. They told me at the Punchline, he used to go like, here you go, John, here's 20, we got to give you something, here's $20. Because he'd take all advances for drugs. And he was a wild man. I mean, he was legendary, you know. I mean, all the women and you know, that's what I said, when John was like, you know, the rumor was that John Fox would go in and masturbate into the drawers of mayonnaise in the comedy condo. So everybody's like, don't ever use anything in the comedy condo refrigerator because John Fox has polluted it with his DNA, you know. But when he was dying just a little while ago, and I talked to him, he was in a hospice dying, and he's like, Scheidner, he goes, you're right, dude. Get the word out there, man. Let people know that was just bullshit. That was just bullshit. I was in a comedy condo, and this young punk comic goes over there and gets mayonnaise out of the refrigerator. And I said, what are you doing? You don't know who's been in that, done what to that. And I told him, I said, hell, every time I come to a comedy condo, first thing I do is masturbate into the mayonnaise jar. And he told everybody like it was the truth. It was a goddamn joke. He said, you know me. You know, I'm too busy chasing women and doing drugs at that time for that kind of shit. I was just joking. Now that's all everybody thinks of me, to think I came into mayonnaise.
It was notorious. When I first went on the road, everybody said, don't ever eat anything
John Fox,
left in a refrigerator.
Yeah, it became like
John Fox jacked off in the mayonnaise.
It became like the comedic boogeyman.
Right.
You better eat all your vegetables or John Fox will get you, you know.
I remember I worked with John a bunch of times, and he was really nice
to
me when I was a young comic. He helped me get gigs with him and stuff. He would walk by the waitress station and announce to no one in particular, fuck me before I'm famous.
He was one of those guys. Yeah. I remember once I was in a club, and there were so many road dogs. Remember Adam Leslie?
Oh my God!
Yeah, Adam was one of those guys.
I have a theragram for you.
Well, he
remember
got
that. That was it. It was his big line. It was like a theragram was like a vitamin pill.
Yeah,
there was a commercial, and his line was, "I have a half a gram for you." I mean, like his jokes were about cocaine.
Exactly. He was this guy who suffered from every comic disease possible. You know, gambled too much, drank too much, drugged too much, chased too many women. You know, and he got kind of bounced out of the circuit early on. You know, he was hanging around with everybody. When I got to New York, he was in it. He was working improv and catching those places. And when the clubs opened, he went out. We were playing poker every week. Mark Schiff, him, myself, other guys were playing poker. Brand Van Hoffman. And I went to Montreal. The first clubs were open were actually up in Canada. Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, those clubs were open. So one week I go work, we've been like 81 or 82. We've been doing it for a little while now. I go up one week, you know, and you could only go back so often because you needed to change material. You know what I mean, Tom? You can't go back in 6 months because you haven't changed your act enough, you know? But I go up there one week in Montreal, and I go, how's it going? They go, oh, great. I said, who was just here? They go, oh, Adam Leslie was just here. Man, he had a whole new act, and it was hilarious. And they start telling me a new act, and joke after joke after joke is Mark Schiff's. Every joke is Mark Schiff. I go, that's not Adam's jokes. Those are Mark Schiff's jokes. And they go, no, they're Adam's jokes. I said, no, they're Mark. And the problem was Mark Schiff was coming a week after me. So, and this is back when the crowds were pretty much, they were all hipster crowds. They were all people who were really into comedy. They would come week after week after week. It wasn't like, you know, they come once and come a year later. Every week you almost had the same people coming. And so Schiff came up there. He was dodging bullets, man. He was like, you know, people were like yelling out, heard it. I was here 2 weeks ago. You know, their stuff was getting to him on his act. And Adam had taken Schiff's whole act to come back early. He wanted to get back in early, so he told him, I got a new act, so book me back in a couple months instead of waiting a year to come back. You know what I mean? And he got banned. He got to come. The comedy community was so small back then.
It's still small. And if you fuck around,
right,
the word gets out. Jokes, words gets out instantly.
Well, it was really small then. And he sort of got bounced out of the circuit. So he had to scramble into the side circuit stuff, you know, and
well, I remember because when I started, like 84, He was doing the Florida crappy one-nighters
a
lot.
That's right. That's
so
what happened.
So he must have just, I mean, that must have been all he had access
that's all
he, to.
That's right. That's exact. I'm just telling you, that's what happened.
And there was a lot of coke in Florida in the 80s.
And he was, I mean, his legendary. I mean, I remember once going into this club, you know, they opened up places that had no business doing stand-up comedy. Atlantic Beach, North Carolina, opened a comedy club, right? And I go in there and this young kid comes up to me and goes, Mr. Scheidner, do you know Adam Leslie? I go, yeah. And he's like freaking. He goes, do you know how to get a hold of him? I said, I don't know if I do. He says, well, what happened? What happened, man? What happened, son? You know, it's like you feel like a Civil War veteran. What happened, son? Did you lose your leg at Antietam? And he goes, well, you know, Adam came in. He said he needed coke. And he asked me if I could find a dealer. And I did. I knew this guy. And he said, can you get him to front me? And I got the guy on my word to front Adam like $1,000 worth of coke. And Adam said he'd pay me before he left. And Adam, the last night, right, he's going to pay this kid after his last night's show. Adam gets paid before the show. He's on stage. He's got his car packed and ready to go out by the emergency door, you know. He finishes the show, says goodnight, kicks open the back door, runs out, jumps in his car and drives off. Leaves the kid stuck with a grand.
Wow.
You know, and that's the kind of stuff that just, you know.
He died a horrific, pathetic death,
terrible,
didn't he? What happened to him? What was his?
Overdose and suicide in Las Vegas last year.
Wow, was it last year?
I think it was last year. Last year. Yeah. He once jumped off a cruise ship because he found, this is so true, this is just Adam Leslie's story. He was on a cruise ship, right? He did a lot of cruises. He got into the cruises. So he's down in Colombia. The cruise goes into Colombia. And Adam gets off the ship walking around the jungle, whatever it was, and runs into a coke manufacturing plant. Like, you know, out in the jungle, they're taking cocoa and turning the paste and coke. So they go, hey, you got Marlboro cigarettes. We'll trade you some coke for some cigarettes. Adam gives us his pack, runs back to the ship, because on the ship you can buy cartons of cigarettes for like $10 a carton, right? Buys a bunch of cartons of cigarettes, packs up his clothes in a bag, and jumps the ship. Goes back on shore and lives for the next few months out in Colombia doing cocaine. Apparently, next time we saw Adam, he was about 80 pounds coming out of the jungle.
He must have been in heaven.
He just got, I found my place. I don't need to work the cruise ship anymore. All I'm doing is for is get coke money. So why cut out the middleman here? Just go right to the coke.
Right.
I got the cigarettes. I trade for the coke. I eat bananas. And that's it. I don't know what he was doing.
How wild did it ever get for you?
Well, it got bad. It got absolutely nuts, you know? I mean, I remember once we were, I was up in Canada and I was doing a gig there and I didn't tell this story. I'll tell it, doesn't matter. So I've been to Four Seasons Hotel, nice hotel. And I'll tell the guy, I don't know, Mike McDonald, right? And so we were pretty wild. And I'd blown my nose out. So Mike says, we can shoot up, you know? And so go to the, you go to a pharmacy up there. If you tell them, just tell them, this is back in, I don't know, what, 84, whatever. You tell them, hey, you know, I got a diabetes problem, you know, and they'll just give you a box of works, you know, box of
syringes.
Syringes, man. They'll just give you the box. Here you go. Here's all you need. A box of disposable thing on 200, whatever it was we had. And we just started running, man. And in no time, you know, it's like they call, hey, you got a show tomorrow night. I ain't doing a show. I'm holed up. And you know, it was like, you think it's going to be fun. And then in no time at all, we got so crazy. We took the beds and made a lean-to against the wall with a box spring and a mattress because I was convinced when the SWAT team came through the windows, right, this would deflect their bullets. You know, that's how paranoid and whacked we were immediately. You know, Mike is squatting by the toilet with one hand on the plunger and the coke waiting for, like, you know, them to come in. We were both seeing ninja running around our apartment. I'm standing there with a peephole just staring out into a hotel hallway for hours at a time. And that went for a couple of days. And I remember going to, Bruce Bell, a comedian named Bruce Bell was sort of like, he had some supplies of things, you know. And we needed, I said, we got to come down, man. I need to come down. And we went over there and he says, you got a problem, man. We've been up for a couple of days. He says, you got a problem. And every time I'd show up, it'd be with a different woman. You know, he goes, you got a problem with women. And it's like ignoring the fact that I've like a syringe hanging out of my arm. Yeah, women's my problem. Just give me some pills, will you? And I ended up, we didn't want to stop. So we go into like 4 in the morning on a Sunday or something. We heard this biker bar. This biker bar would have product, you know. So I go in there with a handful of Canadian bills going, and another comic just happened to be in there. and tells me a story, because I don't even remember this. Came in, and I go up to the pool tables and goes, I need some coke. And like guys are just turning going, who wants to take him off? You know what I mean? Who's going to hit him in the head with a cue stick and take his money? And he came over and sort of negotiated to get what I needed. But it was like, it's over. It was over.
That was your bottom.
Yeah, because I once I got going then, I was like, I'm not, I don't care anymore about doing comedy. The thing that I'd loved the most, the thing that I cared about, what comedy did for me when I first found it was the laughter. I didn't get in this business to make money, and that's working out real well. But I got in this business because I love to hear that laughter. And it made me feel connected to people in a way I could never feel otherwise. I mean, I never felt, I don't know about you, but I never felt, I could be in a crowd and never feel connected. But when I was doing comedy, all of a sudden I felt a connection to people I didn't even know that was closer to anything I ever had. And the laughter was my music, you know. I was making music, and I found this passion I loved. And at the end, I didn't care about it anymore. I wasn't even funny. I was just angry and burnt out and didn't even care if I performed. And so the one thing that I really loved, this other thing had taken away. The alcohol and drugs had taken it away. And I remember when I really bothered, I was, remember Sinbad? You know Sinbad, right?
Oh, yeah.
I worked with Sinbad down in Texas. It was the end of 84. We did like, you know, they had a prison rodeo down there. You know that? They have a prison rodeo.
You've heard
they
of
used
that?
To, yeah. So we performed at that, right? And then we did a couple of one-nighters to end up in Austin. So somehow Sinbad was my middle act for this little run. And I remember one, we got to Austin, man, and he was just happy. He was... First guy was ever running me off the stage. You know, I never
just smoking you,
smoking me, and he was, and I was like, I'm having a hard time keeping up with this guy. You know, I'm up there angry and bitter, and he was just that. I could see the joy in his performance. He didn't have any material; it didn't matter. They just loved him being up there, and he was happy to be there. And it was, and I saw it. And we were sitting in a bar one night, and I'm drinking, and I'm doing coke, and I'm smoking a cigarette. I'm looking at him, and he's across the table, not really talking to me, just laughing, and some people around him's laughing. I thought, the difference between this guy and I is not that he's black or he's young. He's not drinking and doing drugs. That's why he's still getting a kick out of this. It just became obvious to me. I said, I got to get rid of this stuff. It's killing me. And it's killing one thing I ever really loved in terms of, you know, outside of my family or whatever, but it's the only thing that I ever really found that made me feel good about life, and it taking it away. So I had to get rid of it.
So how did you get this?
Well, I got help. Some people took me to a place where other people weren't drinking, and I started doing that and not drinking day at a time. And I had to, and it was hard transition. And I thank Bud Friedman for it, because when I first was getting sober, you know, I was at the improv. I wasn't getting any work on the road. I kind of burned some bridges, and Bud was putting me up night after night at the improv, and I'd walk on stage, and I was so angry. I no longer knew I could drink afterwards, you know, or I couldn't walk on stage with a beer. I didn't have coke in my pocket, and I was angry and scared. And I would slam the mic down or throw it down and walk off after a minute. Remember one guy told me, a buddy of mine told me, he was, you know, a comic kid, he's in the audience. He said, one night I was up there ranting and raving, just real angry. Nobody's laughing. He laughed at something. I turned to him and went, what are you laughing at?
As a comedian.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I don't know, it's a comedy club. I thought maybe I should, I don't know. But I thought I was done. I thought, even though I knew I couldn't drink and do drugs anymore, I thought, I'm done with comedy because nothing's funny coming to me. Nothing's funny coming. And I started running again. I had run when I was younger, you know, and I started running, but I was smoking. I would take cigarettes in my, like William Hurt in Body Heat. I would have them cigarettes in my sock, you know, and I'd run for 100 feet and stop and smoke a cigarette and run. But I started running, and one day I was out running, and a joke came to me. You know, like jokes, sometimes they land, and it's just, oh my God, that's ready. And like most times you get a joke lands, it's a little bird's broken its wing, you got to fix it and kind of take it on stage and massage it and make it. But a joke came to me, and I couldn't wait to run back to my house and my little apartment I was living in and write it down and go to stage that night, and it worked, and I went, oh my God, I'm going to write jokes again. Because I thought I was done. I thought I was out of material. I thought I was out. I was never write again. And a joke worked. And I can remember the joke. I was like, I said, you know, in relationships, you no matter how much you love the other person, there's always going to be those moments in any day where one minute you look at the other person, you think to yourself, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with you. And your next thought could be, how can I fake my death? And it got a big laugh that night, and I went, okay, it made, you know, it's like, I can do this. I think I can get back with this.
So once you cleaned up, the jokes started coming back organically?
And I got more work than ever. I mean, I got, you know, I had like 5 development deals for my own series. I did an HBO special. I'd been banned from The Tonight Show, and I got back on The Tonight Show. That was a whole other. I did material I wasn't supposed to do. My second Tonight Show.
What they told you? Don't do this stuff. And you,
Jim McCauley. I was like, you know, I was hanging out with Sam Kennison, and I wanted to be edgy, and I wanted to do religious material. I wanted to, so I was doing my second Tonight Show. My first Tonight Show went really well. I was doing my second one, and you know, you set the material, you know, it's all locked in place. And when we get to the, and I couldn't stop drinking. The first time I quit drinking about a week before the first Tonight Show, so I kind of got myself a little in shape and balanced, you know, and straight. But the second one, all I could do was not do drugs the night before. I didn't stay up all night doing coke, but I drank some. And so that next day when I was at the Tonight Show backstage, I'm trying to convince Jim McCauley to let me do a couple of religious jokes to close my set. And he's like, no, you can't do this, can't do this. And then I switched gears on him. I went, well, forget that. I want to do these jokes about, remember Barney Clark, the first heart recipient, artificial heart recipient? Yeah. That was Dewes then. So I had a joke about him and about the defibrillators, you know, the things that you put on for the heart attack.
Right, get someone's heart going.
Right. I did jokes about that and the defibrillators. And he's like, I don't know, but I was so obsessed and so crazed, I convinced him to let me do them. Against his better wish, he was like, I don't know about these jokes, but I was so like, Jimmy, you gotta let me do it, man. I gotta let me, come on. And I bugged the shit out of him, and he let me do them. And you know how you know, the first time I got the circle with the fingers, you know, like, you're okay. I didn't get panel, but I got that okay sign. There's three signals you get. Come on over for panel, like Stephen Wright got the first time. This, the signals, which is okay, you'll come back another night. Good job. Come back another night. Or if you look over and Johnny's not looking at you and he's tapping his pencil on his little cigarette box, they might as well pull the trap door on you, man. You bombed in front of Johnny. And I look over the second time and Johnny's tapping the pencil and he's not even looking at me. So I turn, I walk back at the curtain, and McCauley grabs me from the curtain. I mean, immediately, he knew something was wrong, and he says, get to the dressing room. Come on, come back. And he gets me in the dressing room, and he hands me a beer, and he says, don't leave here. Just stay right here. And he comes back like a half hour later and says, oh, I screwed up, man. I should have let you do those jokes. Johnny hated those heart attack jokes because Johnny smokes 2-pack of Pall Mall non-filters a day, and he's scared to death of a heart attack. And you did those heart attack jokes, and he hated them. So it was about a few months after I got sober, 6 months, 9 months, whatever, that I was switched and the whole thing changed for me. And McCauley gave me another shot. He talked him into letting me come back. And he said, you got to see this guy. He's all different now. He's all different. I mean, McCauley sold him on me. And I was different. Everything changed. So within that year, I came back and then I did like, you know, 14 more, whatever I did.
How many Tonight Shows with Johnny Carson did you do?
14, 16, something like that.
Did he ever call you to the count?
Yeah. Not all the time. After that, I think it took me 4 times to go through panel. And then after that, it was like, if you got enough time, you do it. If you got enough time, you do it. Like sometimes he goes, there's not enough time. You just look, we're not sure whether there'll be enough time. When you finish, look over to Johnny, and if he gives you this and he waves, you go back to the curtain. If he goes like this, come on over. So I wasn't a guaranteed.
So did you ever review the tapes? All right. I got 8 okay signals. I got 4 calls to the panel. And I got 3 taps.
No, I only got 1 tap with a pencil. Okay. That was enough. I was lucky to come back on 1. Yeah. And then I did a bunch of Lettermans. I was doing Letterman by then, so it was okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember you very classy on stage. I mean, on this Tonight Show on Letterman, you know, in a suit, looking sharp.
Yeah.
Very smart material.
Well, I was cleaned up then.
That was after you.
That was after 85, yeah. Yeah, I did, all my success came, you know, after 85, really, that's when it really, all the things were happening good for me was then, because I cleaned up, had focus and clarity, and was able to, you know, be a decent person, not be a, you know, complete a-hole to everybody.
How did you quit cigarettes?
About 3 years in, I just had it. It was tough. I was smoking about a pack or so of Camel non-filters a day, and I just had it. But I'm telling you, man, I have every empathy for. And you know what's funny? The tide was turning, man. You know, it's like I used to be on the planes and smoking cigarettes in the smoking section of the plane. And all of a sudden, I just noticed there was no smoking. You know, it was like they were cutting places out of smoke. I just sensed the tide was changing and it might be a good time to quit anyway. You know, smokers become a pariah. I mean, you start treating like a crack addict, you know. And so I just went cold turkey and it was tough. And I hallucinated. I mean, I was like out of my skull. Not smoking at first. It was tough. It was the toughest thing. It was tougher than the other stuff. In some ways, yeah. Because everything gets tied to it, you know. If I get on the telephone, I'd light up a cigarette. If I got in the car, I'd light up a cigarette. You know, obviously, after sex, have a cigarette. You know, get up in the morning, have a cigarette. Finish eating, have a cigarette. There were a lot of things tied to having cigarettes. A lot of activities were just tied to it. Yeah, it's tough.
I remember, it seemed Bill Hicks, you know, really achieved true greatness once he cleaned up and stopped partying and doing drugs.
That's totally true.
And you said you were
Bill called Bill called me and said I want to stop drinking and doing drugs. I know you have. because we used to drink and do drugs together. And we worked on the road early in the career. You know, I met Bill, it was 83 down in Austin, Texas. He was my middle act, and we did a bunch of gigs together because we liked to work with each other because we both liked mushrooms and we both liked lots of things that were similar, chemical experiences and drinking. And so we liked working together and we liked hanging out. And then he called me up. I was about three years sober or something. And he said, I got to quit, man. It's killing me. I got to quit. I said, I know you have. I said, I'll help you out, man. So I took him to the same place that I've been going and introduced him to some people and talked to him. We talked on the phone every day. And he quit. And the change, man, was unbelievable. I mean, he always had it. Everybody knew he had it. But when he got that clarity, everything just went to another level. And even during that time, you know, they had that incident where Leary stole all of his material and his sort of his act. And he didn't drink or do drugs over it. He just kind of like, well, I've already moved on from that material anyway. It doesn't matter. And I just went, wow. I mean, he just, something else clicked in him. And then it was like, you know, you just heard people talking about him. You just heard people talking about him. Did you hear that new bit he did? You hear that bit he did? You know how it is. You know, did you hear that bit he did? And people were just talking about Hicks and Hicks and Hicks. And I'd see him from time to time. And every time I saw him, it was like another leap in growth. You know, whatever he was talking about. Everybody does jokes about commercials. But Hicks was doing jokes about what was behind the commercials and how they were really selling us, you know, and not just of a specific commercial. He was taking the whole thing down. You know, and his jokes were different on religion than Sam's. Were like, Kennison's jokes on religion were like mine. We were making fun of the believers, but we never really challenged the very existence of God. We never really challenged the believers. So you leave them to have that and you can make fun of the believers and get away with it. But Hicks was going after God, man. He was going right after the belief system, man. Oh, there's some people who go, you know, I want to be like Bill Hicks. I go, yeah, you ready to walk a room? You ready to walk a room?
Yeah.
I saw that guy walk a room and not back down. You know, and if five people are left, he goes, all right, these are my five people. I'm building from here. You five people are my fans. You're my disciples. You go out and tell other people about me.
There was a story about Bill that he was doing some corporate gig, and
the very fact he's doing a corporate gig.
It was like at the San Francisco Punchline and the Walnut Creek Punchline, the suburban room that no longer exists, and I think it was at the Walnut Creek room that some like Exxon corporation had wanted to buy the night and buy the room for them. And they kept saying, no, this isn't the guy. This isn't the comedian you want. And they said, no, we want to do it. And they go, look, you're not going to like this guy. And they said, no, we want to do it. And so they buy the room and the whole place is packed with these Exxon corporate people and they hate him. And they're all getting up and leaving.
Yeah.
And it just in mass, they're all getting up and leaving. And the famous story is Bill says to them, he goes, look, you may not like my jokes, but none of my jokes ever killed a pelican or caused an oil spill and killed wildlife.
Oh, he was great, man. He was great. And he knew, look, he could still, even when he was making his transition to what he became, you know, he could still go, you know, if he wanted to crank into a regular comedy club act, right, he could do it. He used to say, all right, everybody, relax. I'm going to pull the parachute cord here and we'll safely land in a dick joke island. Right? You know, he could do that. But it got to the point where he didn't want to do it anymore. He didn't want to do what they wanted him to do. And he did what he, you know, it's so funny when you talk about, it's always been that way. Like, people don't match an audience. You ever heard of Jackie Leonard story? Remember Jackie Leonard? Jackie Leonard was a big comic in the 40s, 50s. He was a big guy. He was the king of the savers. He did all those lines that people still use today. Hey, I wasn't born here, but it looks like I'm going to die here. And I'm doing like Rodney. I only have one impression. But anyway, he was literally a big guy, a big comic, and he was famous, very hip comic. He was, Don Rickles got his thing from Jackie Leonard. Jackie Leonard would put the whole crowd down and make fun of him. But Rickles took one at a time. That's how he changed it and made it his own and did a different thing. But anyway, Jackie Leonard, this guy calls up the agent and from the Catskills and says, I saw Jackie Leonard down the city. I want to book him up my hotel in the Catskills. And the agent goes, listen, Jackie Leonard's not right for the Catskills. You don't want Jackie. And he goes, I want Jackie. I'm going to have Jackie. If you don't book him, I'll call another agent to book him and I'll give him the commission. He goes, all right, I'll give you Jackie. So he books Jackie up at some, you know, Grossinger, some Catskill hotel. Jackie walks out. You know, there's all these, you know, religious Jews with big brim hats on and all. He walks out. The first thing he says was, welcome, Shriners. You know, just bombs a horrible death. But he doesn't back. He just spends time making, you know, the whole time making fun of the audience. He didn't care. He's going to do what he's going to do. It just wasn't the right fit.
So what about Bill Maher? You're working with Bill now? Yeah. Bill Maher working on a script now?
Bill wrote a book, you know, the book, True Story, wrote it back in 92.
I forget where I was years ago, I think Australia, and all these young comedians were reading Bill Maher's True Stories that someone had told them, if you wanted to be a comedian, this was the book to read.
And it's really, you got a lot of great insights. It's about that time period of 79 to 80.
Anyway, the fictitious characters in it are actually Jerry Seinfeld and
they're all mixed, and Mike Caine and Gilbert Gottfried and Ron Zimmerman and all these different characters became amalgams. You know, David Say and Richard Belzer, who were big top comics, and Adrian Talsh, Catch a Rising Star. So Bill was sort of, Catch a Rising Star was his club. So that became sort of the prototype in, you know, Rick Newman, who owned and ran Catch, was sort of one of the characters in there. So I guess since then, they've done about 14 scripts trying to figure out a way to make this into a movie. HBO wants to do it again. They're trying to. It has a lot of, look, it has nostalgia. It's from 1980. It's pre, it happens right when things start to break. So it has that period when nobody's making any money and a bunch of young comics running around ready to burst out in the scene, you know. They got acts, but they don't have any place to do them. And then the clubs started opening and people started making money and things started changing, you know. I mean, it's funny when you put money in the equation. I mean, that's the same thing with, you know, the strike of 79, which you know heard about it, you know, but
right,
everybody's having a good time at Comedy Store. Nobody cares when they're charging $2 a head and nobody's making any money. Mitzi's not making any money and comics aren't making money. Nobody cares. All of a sudden, they start upping the price. The place becomes packed. They open another room, then another room. Money starts flowing. All of a sudden, things start getting separate, you know, and money sort of comes into the equation and changed everything. And it was the same way in New York. And so we're trying to figure out a way to make this movie into...
And that book is of that time period.
Of that time
when
period.
The when the strike happens.
No, yeah, strike happened in L.A. It didn't happen in New York, although there was talk of it. But the club owners in New York, you know, they headed it off at the steam. You know, they were all, you know, Catch a Rising Star was notoriously a mob. Somewhere there was a mob running that club. Because there were too many mobsters in there all the time, paying no money. You heard of Jerry Seinfeld's story, right?
Mm-mm.
Seinfeld's on stage and Catch a Rising Star. Now, Seinfeld didn't deal with hecklers well, so to speak. He didn't ever really deal with them. If people started talking in the show, Jerry would just stop talking himself and wait till the whole room would be staring at the people who were talking. Then he'd be embarrassed and he'd continue. Well, this one guy who's constantly there, this mobster's there, he's holding court, he's talking. Jerry's up there. Jerry stops talking. The guy's like looking around, realizing everybody's looking at him. He goes, "What?" Then he looks at Jerry and goes, "What?" And Jerry's like saying whatever he say, you know, like, "Well, I'm going to talk or you're going to talk. What's your choice here?" The guy just takes his drink glass and throws it at Jerry, you know, just wings it by Jerry's hair, hits the brick wall. Well, Rick Newman, the owner, goes, "Get Jerry off stage now." And they run up and they hustle Jerry off. And Jerry comes off and Jerry's like, "Oh, you're going to throw him off?" He goes, "No, Jerry, I'm giving you $100. Go home now. Leave now. As fast as you can, get out of here." The mobster didn't move. They didn't throw him out. They just brought another act up. It's the same guy a couple weeks later. You know the Piscopo story, right?
Mm-mm.
Well, Piscopo's on stage. Joe Piscopo, who did Saturday Night Live and all. His whole thing was he messed with the audience, do a lot of crowd work. So he sees these guys sitting there and he goes, "Hey, what are you guys, hit men from New Jersey?" Bingo! He comes off the stage. They grab him, take him in the coat room, break his nose.
Wow.
Then same thing. Here's some money. Take Joe to the hospital. Take care of him. See you in a week, Joe. Don't come back for a week. Here's some money. Stay away for a little while.
Wow.
The mobster busts Joe's nose, walks back in, sits back at his table, orders another drink.
Wow.
So this is all part of what was happening back then.
So what could a comedian most get out of Bill Maher's True Stories?
What it's like to do it. We're hoping. Look, nobody's made. You've seen all the movies. Punchline was terrible.
Horrible movie.
Horrible. We're trying to make. I mean,
comedians
don't
have lockers.
Everything
they
about
have lockers.
That. I can go endless. I've seen that movie recently.
Jesus.
I watched them all again. They're all terrible.
And then he's crying outside.
Oh,
he's
know.
Looking at Sarah.
And he's on stage crying, it's just terrible.
God.
It's terrible. So we're. You know, somebody's got to make the raging bull of comedy sooner or later.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that that's what we're doing. We want to get that real feeling of what it's like when you're up there and you're getting heckled and you're trying to do a new joke and you're trying to get ahead. And the realizations that what you need to make to get better along the way. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like at first you think it's antagonistic. It's me against them. Then at some point, you probably hit this too, Tom, that you go, "We're working together, me and this audience. We're like part of a band. I may be the leader here, but I need these people following me, man. So I gotta work with them in a sense too. You know. So it's all these little realizations along the way, and we're hoping that when you watch a movie and you go, they nailed it. They got it. They got it. That's what it's like. That's what it's like to do it. That's the obsessive, you know, the obsessive nature. Like when you come home and you got scraps of paper you pull out of your pocket with matchbook covers you've written a joke on and a piece of toilet paper and a napkin, cocktail napkin, you've written these jokes. Or like, well, I'll tell you one of these. Like, you ever been having sex and you come up with a joke idea and you're like, got a pad by the bed, you're still going at it and you're going, oh, hold on, just hold on a minute, I gotta write this idea down. You know, it's like, what's more important, the sex or the joke? Not even it's the joke.
Well, you've experienced longevity like few people ever experience in this business, and I'm thrilled that, you know, you still work and you're still an important writer in the comedy world. What's the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
Well, Phyllis Diller said the same thing that Rodney said when I met Phyllis Diller years later. I mean, she called me after one of my Tonight shows. It's like, this is Phyllis Diller. I just want to talk. I thought it was a prank call, you know, I became friends with her. And the best advice she ever gave me is what Rodney gave me. And you got to get on stage all the time. You got to get on stage all the time. You can't take off. And listen to what the audience is laughing at. They'll tell you what's funny about yourself. Like, I couldn't do political material. I tried to do political material. I tried to do deep social material. And if whatever it is, my voice, the jersey, the stupid voice that I have that sounds like a blue collar, whatever it was, they went, nah, not from you. But if I talked about relationships, I just noticed the laughs got bigger. If I talked about men and women, the laughs got bigger. So I said, if I come up with a political joke, I give it to Mar. I'm going to do more of these, and more of these, and more of these. So listen to what they're laughing about. They'll tell you what they find funny about you.
What's it like working with Bill Maher?
I've known Bill since 79. So I like Bill. I get a kick out of him. I think he's brilliant. And he works hard. He works hard. You know the whole thing. I'm going to blow it. You know the whole image of Bill is he's a wake and bake guy. You know, non-stop, 24/7. You know, because he's an advocate of pot.
No, but I picture him at his castle being fanned by Playboy playmates. I mean,
No, he works hard on the show, and he uses pot, by and large, when he's working, like maybe twice a week, just to write, just to polish, like Carlin used to. You know, Carlin would write his jokes, write his material, and then he'd get a little pot to rewrite, you know.
Right. He said punch-up time.
Punch-up time, right, Carlin smoked, right.
He only smoked pot to punch up the jokes.
Right, and that's like Mar is, you know. He's kind of a Dean Martin of pot, you know. Dean Martin didn't really drink like everybody said he drank. It was just an image.
Right.
And Mar's like, he's very hard working. He's very disciplined guy.
I like the last time I saw you, we were on the Ardent Atheist.
Oh, that
podcast.
Was a great show. I love that. We had such fun.
And I thought you and I deflected, because it's like, atheists, they're almost as rabid as born-again Christians. That they want you to believe the way they believe.
Yeah, you gotta believe I don't believe. And nobody knows. That's the whole thing. It's like, you know, Leonard Cohen song. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. Everybody knows, but nobody knows. You know? They don't know. When you die, nobody's come back. I don't know anybody. You know, people think they've come back. But nobody's come back. Nobody's come back with any proof, you know? Here's a bit of the cross Jesus gave me.
Yeah.
Nobody's come, so nobody knows. They don't know. And you know the funny thing about being an atheist? When you die, you won't even know you're right if you're right. You'll become nothing. So there'll be no consciousness to even know you're right. So there has to be more faith to be an atheist, actually, than there has to be a believer.
I thought you and I deflected it very well. And I thought we defended our beliefs beautifully.
Very well. Very well.
Rich, you're one of my heroes in the comedy world, and I'm thrilled to know that you were one of the guys that I saw when I was 12 years old, and the night
I'm so psyched because I've been watching you for a long time, following you for a long time. You know, I admire the way you went international and you found your own path. I love that. Since we're going to stroke each other, let's do it right. You know, do you remember when we first met?
No, where did we first meet?
Up in one of those gigs. It was like one that was owned by an Oakland A's baseball player in San Rafael.
Oh my God, the Tommy T's.
With the baseball, the diamond for a home plate. You perform in home plate. You remember that? And you were the opening act, right? You had long hair. And I never met you. We didn't know the Brookmas thing. We didn't even have any idea.
Yeah.
We had no idea about
it. I didn't know that then.
We didn't know about that, right? And we're backstage, and you were listening to rap, right? And you go, hey, I rap. You doing rap? And I go, I don't know rap. You're like, you're the first time I felt like an old man. You go, you don't know rap, old man? I mean, you didn't say it, but he looked at me like, you don't know rap? You don't know this guy, that guy? I go, I just know classic rock. It was hilarious.
That was like 91 NWA, yeah. Like the hardest.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you were
hardest ghetto shit.
You know, I had my Walkman on. I'm listening like the Elvis Costello or Eric Clapton. And you're back there going, and I'm like, what's he doing, man? What are you doing? He goes,
rock. Fuck the police, yeah. Coming straight from the underground. Ice Cube will swarm on any motherfucker in a blue uniform. Yeah, that was some pretty hard shit.
Yeah, and you ran hard too. I remember that week. I had to run. I had to get up on stage and shake. You ran hard. You were young and you were very likable and very good looking. And you ran it hard. I love that.
Well, I love you to death. I'm glad you were there, man. The night that changed my life forever. In closing, do you have any words of wisdom or advice you'd like to give the people of the earth?
Be nice. I'd say that to every comic, too. Be nice. Be nice. Be nice to the other comics, because those are the guys who get you jobs when you get up, when you're coming up. You know, make your friends and be nice. You never know. You never know. You never know. The guy you think is not going to make it, he may make it, and he may give you a job. Be nice.
That's true.
That's it.
All right, Rich, the next book you write, I'm going to give you a better story. Long may you run, brother. Long may you run, Rich Heidner. Thanks, man.